there are many questions. Some are about my personal life. But if I devote my time to answer all these things, but the most important thing about Nibbana, we won't have enough time. Therefore, I start with my talk about Nibbana. Nibbana, literal meaning is pacification, peace. Now, under the term Nibbana, there are many experiences we find in the text. There is Sammati Nibbana. Sammati means convention. Conventional Nibbana, conventional peace. Suppose there is a war all around you. A war is waged. Parties are fighting each other. Then you are at unrest. In your mind there is no peace. But suppose you hear that fighting has stopped forever. No more fighting after this. When you hear this message, immediately your restlessness is removed. You feel much comforted. You feel much peaceful. You feel much released, much calm. This sort of experience is called Sammati Nibbana, conventional Nibbana. But it is not nothingness. Because you experience it, you feel it. A man suffering from a severe disease, he was at risky condition. Even doctors and relatives are suspicious of his life. And he also feels suspicious. He is at unrest. But anyway, when doctor comes and examines and says, now don't be afraid, you are now getting better. Then he feels much comfort, much happy, much in peace, much peaceful. This kind of peace you experience, these kinds of happiness in mind, everybody experiences it. It is not nothingness. But you can't experience, you can show out to the outer person your inner peace. You experience it for yourself. This is Sammati Nibbana. Now there is another Nibbana. It is called Micchaditthi Nibbana. Micchaditthi means, here Micchaditthi refers to materialists. Materialistic type of people don't believe in rebirth. They don't believe in any type of practices in religion. Whatever religion may be, they don't believe, they don't care. Their belief is, at death we are finished. They are materialists. That is materialism. Now, according to them, real Nibbana is what is that? So long as we live, eat, then drink and enjoy as much as possible. enjoy sensual pleasures, because you live for a short time. After that there is nothing. Enjoy here. Enjoy as much as possible. So they do it. They feel some sort of peace in their mind, happiness. Though it is materialistic view, that also is there. That kind of experience is there. Though we don't approve of or appreciate it as a great thing. Now beyond these two, there is another kind of nibbana called tadanga nibbana. Now, you are listening to me. At this moment, as good qualities are ruling over your mind, good qualities are rising in your mind at this time, wholesome good qualities. No evil, any evil quality finds to rise up within you. As you are engaged in concentration or listening to Dhamma, no other bad thoughts find opportunity to rise in your heart, in your mind. So, by good qualities, the bad qualities are suppressed for some time. This is temporary nibbana, temporary peace in heart. When you see a Buddha picture, when you feel much faith and devotion and love, and you bow down, at the moment your mind is full of peace. Therefore, no bad qualities rise up. You experience this peace. This is called tadanga nibbana. When you develop your samadhi, concentration, when you attain to the jhanic, mystic trance state, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and all the jhana stage. Stage by stage, your passions are more and more suppressed. They don't raise their head. They don't rise up. Your mind, as all these passions are suppressed, your mind is at peace for a long time, but not perfectly. So long as you are practicing, and so long as you are in this meditative state, your mind is at peace. Passions are suppressed. This is called vikambana nibbana. Vikambana means suppression. By means of the development of concentration or jhana, the passions have been suppressed at that moment. And it influences for hours and hours. Your mind is at peace. You experience it. This is called vikambana nibbana. Now when you practice vipassana, so long as you are practicing it, passions are suppressed. They don't rise up. That is also vikambana nibbana. The peace of mind that you experience, the peace of mind present due to the practice of vipassana, passions being suppressed. Then when you develop your vipassana to a very high level, then you develop your mind to a certain state at which you see the sorrowful nature all over the world, suffering nature. Very quickly, in a very short time, you see the world as full of sorrow, and you remove some passions, and at the moment, as your mind is very pure, the glimpse of Nibbana is there. You see the vision of Nibbana for the first time. And your mind is fixed on Nibbana. By cutting off egoistic belief, doubt, or skepticism about the practice, and such weaknesses are rooted out at the moment, then mind becomes pure and strong, and for the first time it opens to see the inner nature, and it sees Nibbana and experiences it. It is not nothingness, you experience it, you experience Nibbana, you cease mentally Nibbana and enjoys it. It is not nothingness. This is the first, this is called samuccheda Nibbana. Samuccheda means cutting away, rooting out. Some passions are rooted out, mind becomes pure, and the Nibbana, the vision of Nibbana is there before you. You experience it. It is not nothingness. There is something you experience. After that, so slowly you pass on four stages, sotapatti, sagadagami, anagami, and arhant. In all the four stages you see Nibbana in this way, cutting off passions or weakening passions, and at last then you become an arhant, a perfect person, rooting out all passions. Then perfectly you see Nibbana mentally, and you fix your mind there, and you feel much peaceful, you experience this. And after that, whenever you want, remember Nibbana, which you have seen, and fix your mind on that. Then, sometimes for a week, you are in the same position, forgetting everything else, ignoring all the other things. Even you don't want to eat, in the same position, for a week, you remain experiencing the bliss of Nibbana, fixing your mind on that. This is called saupadisesa Nibbana. The Nibbana you experience while still you are bearing or holding this physical body. Then this physical body is a collection of rising and vanishing state, together with mind, your present mind, worldly mind. This is also rising and vanishing momentarily. Now, when an arahant, when you attain the arahantship, you pass away from this state. At the last stage, your thought process, when seeing Nibbana, your thought process, it's force. We have a force, some vital force, to continue. But instead of continuing to rise as thought, that vital force is become joined with what it has so far experienced now and then, that which was hidden within him, that is Nibbana. We call it anupadisesa Nibbana. After the eighth state of an arahant, so that is perfect Nibbana. It is indescribable, beyond description, by means of words. It is infinite. There is no limit to it. Lord Buddha said, Parinibbutasana Pamana Matti. As regards the person who has passed away, an arahant who has passed away, his nature after death is immeasurable. You can't measure. But it is not nothingness. So far, so long, little by little you rise up, experiencing the temporary nibbanas. Now this perfect nibbana also is not nothingness, but we can't use any positive words to express that perfect nibbana is like this or like that, because we use words. We have words. All words are coined. I mean, all words have been formed by us to express something in the world which we see or hear or experience. But all those things are conditioned things, breakable things, things subject to change and death. Every word in the world like that. There is no positive word in the world to express the eternal nibbānic bliss. Therefore, all the terms, all the words in the world are not able to express the positive nature of Nibbāna, because our words are referring to the things in the world which are conditioned. With such words, if we try to express Nibbāna, we would mistake Nibbāna as one conditioned thing, one thing in the Nibbāna. So it is beyond words. I take some illustration. A froggy is living in a pond, a frog. She had her small children, tadpoles, which are swimming in the water. They can't come out of the land, still they have not legs grown up, only they can move, they can swim in the water. One day, frog came out, came to the land, and moved here and there, and returned to the water, returned to the pond. Then her children, the tadpoles, asked, "Mother, where did he go? You were absent. Where were you?" She said, "I went to land. I went to the land." Then these tadpoles asked, "What is land? Can we swim in it?" The mother frog said, "No, you can't swim the land." "Then can we sink down and come up in it?" "No, you can't do it in that place." So, everything referring to water. These tadpoles, these little frogs, questioned her about such things, because they know only that, those things, those experiences in water, to each and everything. Every question they asked, the mother frog said, "No, no, no." Then they said, "Oh, mother, now we have realized what land is." "How have you realized?" she asked. "Well, land is nothing, nothingness." "How do you say? Why do you say?" "Well, to each and every question we asked you about the necessary things for a living person, you answered, 'No, no, no.'" So these little fellows tried to measure land through the qualities of water. So they can't catch it. likewise. Then the mother frog said, "Wait, be careful from watery snakes till you grow up like me, and then you will be able to go to land and experience it. Then you will see there is land which is entirely, directly opposite to watery nature. Up to that moment you feel the water is the reality, not the land. Land is an imagination, so you may think, you may consider, but wait, don't be in a hurry. When the time comes, you will be able to experience both water and land. Then you will understand that there is something called land. Likewise, till we develop vipassana, at least to enter the sotapatti stage, the stage of entering the path, entering the holy path, entering the stream, at which for the first time you see Nibbana very clearly. Till you attain to that state, you may have some doubt about Nibbana, it is natural. And to each and every question you ask them depending on the terms of the world. All the terms, all the words of the world are expressive of conditioned things, not unconditioned things. From this you have to understand Nibbana is not nothingness, it is some state, some another dimension. Perhaps fourth or fifth or sixth dimension, entirely different state but existing. It is there, it is not the world. Quite opposite to the world. There are so many things to say about Nirvana. Now, this much is quite enough to clear your doubts. Because I have to give some answers to other questions. It is a personal one. What motivated you to become a monk? As a boy of 8, in 1902, a certain gentleman came to our village, Balangbure, in the central part of Sri Lanka. This person was called Valisinga Harishchandra, the first people to late Anagarika Dharampala. He was a Buddhist missionary, very calm and quiet and saintly appearance, wearing some white clothes just like an ascetic, very calm, quiet, like a hermit. He gave 2 talks at our school. I was in the third standard. I was 8 years old, and we listened to him. He talked about patience, kindness, not getting angry, non-violence, on such subjects. He spoke to us in a very simple language that these children could easily understand. So his talk struck so hard within us that we were drawn to him. He gave 2 talks with magic lantern pictures. Those days we don't have cinemas. We don't have these other new instruments, and with a a gramophone. You know, gramophone, but perhaps you have not heard it. Even then, now there is no more gramophone. The first gramophone was invented in America when late Anagari Dhanapala came and gave some talks on Buddhism. The inventor of that machine presented that gramophone with some records to him. And with that gramophone record, they took talks into these gramophone records, and they make the machine speak. It is a new thing to children, even to the adults in our country those days, in 1902. So with this, he made this machine to sing songs, to give talks, and all people were gathered there. They are surprised to see new things. So we children, with much admiration, we were listening to these talks. And magic lantern picture. On a screen, he tore a picture onto a screen, picture of the children of other countries and so on. And he describes them and he teaches some lesson to us. So 2 days he gave talks. On the third day morning, those days I was staying in my father's shop. He had two shops there. In one shop near the school, I was staying under my guardian. There was a guardian person appointed to keep me and train me by my father, one old gentleman, very learned. So under him I was being trained, and I told him, I asked him, who is that gentleman who spoke to us last 2 days? Oh, well, he's a great, saintly man. What is he doing? Well, he's teaching Buddhism everywhere. Then I said, I also want to be like him. This is the first time I turned my mind towards religion. I want to like him and become a Buddhist missionary. I told him. All right, that is good. So it went on like that. Every time I, a boy of 8, say, when I grow up, I don't live a family life. I live alone, teaching and preaching and going from village to village, teaching Buddhism. I become a brahmachari. Brahmachari means celibate, a man living a celibate life. That person also was a man of that type, like Harishchandra, who spoke to us. I must be. So every time he says like that, I say like that. Now and then, a certain monk of very saintly form used to come over there. Our shop was situated at a junction. That monk comes from a certain temple and at this junction turned towards another road. So my guardian, when he sees this monk, he invites and prepare a seat and give him something to drink and makes me bow down at his feet. So I had much contact with that monk. That monk was very saintly, calm, quiet. Then one day my guardian told me, if you like to become a Buddhist missionary, become a monk like that person who comes over here now and then. Then I changed my thought and I said, I must become a monk. So every time I used to say, I must become a monk. This idea, it struck within my heart. So when I passed my all standards, the final of my school, I was 13, and I was too young to sit for higher examination those days. The next examination is the teacher's examination. I like to become a teacher also. So our headmaster appointed me a monitor, to teach, to take classes. And I was being trained for teacher's examination till the proper age comes, according to those regulations at that time. At least one must be 18 to take that examination. So I was being trained. Meanwhile, in the daytime, this is morning session, afternoon session, I used to learn English. Then one day my father said, now you have finished your school work, now why are you going to school? And meanwhile I have got two scholarships to go to Colombo, to Royal College, the highest college at the time, and to learn English. All free, because I passed some examination too young. Therefore, I got two scholarships. So my father wanted to send me to Colombo. But always I was thinking I must become a monk. But my father didn't agree. My mother didn't agree. When I tell this matter, they keep silent, they don't say anything. They are making arrangements for me to go to a distant place, to a high school, to learn English, to Colombo or to Ratnapura. There are two places at that time where there are two high schools. Then when the time comes for my departure to Colombo or to the other place, I hid myself. I bolted away. I ran away so that my father couldn't find me out for 3 or 4 days. I go to some other place of my distant place where my relatives were. So several times I did this. Then at last, now I was not studying. I was not doing anything in our shop. My father asked, if you don't do these things, then look after our tea estate. I said, no, I don't want tea estate. Then look after our fields, paddy fields. No, I don't want. Then what do you want? I want to enter the order of monks. Then he said, you are a very mischievous fellow. Those days I was very, very hot-tempered. Very quickly I got angry and quarrel. Very hot-tempered and very disobedient. I was obedient only to my teacher in the school, nobody else. I was disobedient to my parents. I didn't listen to them. I did according to my will and wish. I didn't listen to him. So he said, you can't live a monk's life. You are a very mischievous fellow. Therefore, give up this idea. Give up this hope to enter order. No, I want to be a monk. So I urged him over and over again. Then at last, they couldn't do anything. They couldn't refuse it. Then mother told my father, well, let us try, let us allow him to enter the order. Then father said, he doesn't remain long in the temple, he will quarrel with these monks and return. Let him do, then he will return home again. Till that time, let us allow him to do whatever he likes. Let us see. Then my father agreed, and on the following morning, he took me to the nearest monastery in which the incumbent was the monk whom I saw most often during my young days, when I was in shop. It's a wonderful coincidence. Then under him, then I was 15 years old, I entered the order as a novice, and I learned Pali, Sanskrit and Dhamma under him for 9 years. Every time my father, when he comes to our temple, secretly asks my teacher, how is our novice? Is he not mischievous? They were always suspecting that someday I would return home. But on the day I entered the order, a friend of mine, told me, why are all these people suspicious of your being in this order? You are very always growing rough and hot-tempered. Why is it? Then I said, I don't know. I feel hot very suddenly. Then why? What is the meaning of your being a monk? I said, I want to become a monk. I want to teach people. I want to spread Buddhism. What do you spread as Buddhism? To getting angry? Is it your Buddhism that you are going to teach? Then I was convinced. Then I told him, Venerable, a young monk of my type, after this I never get angry. Then make a resolution before me, promise. Yes, I never get angry. Even though I am beaten or scolded or whatever, I try to control myself. I don't show an even hot face. I try to keep silent and bear the trouble. I don't get angry. So I made a strong promise. Every time when I was about to feel angry, I remember it. And my teacher, that chief monk, he was a wonderful person, like an arahant, very saintly, very holy. And his example made me, I mean, his example corrected me very much, to great extent. And whenever people come and ask him about me, because my father was an important person of the whole area, therefore people are somewhat interested about my being in the order. So they come and ask, how is the son of that rich man? Is he in good order? Oh yes, this young monk is very good. He is calm and quiet, and he is he likes to learn, always reading, and he lives a very calm life. Most often I hear these words. Then I felt, now my teacher speaks well of me. I must try to make him not to speak any ill of me. So, for about 3 years I tried in this way to control myself. Then it became a habit. Then I could bear any trouble. I could live like my teacher. I began to live a very simple life, bearing any trouble. When I learned much Dhamma, then it taught me much about the value of virtues, patience, and then I determined to enter on the Bodhisattva path. Then, according to my determination, I changed myself a great deal. That is how I entered the order and have come to this way, the present way. What do you see for the future of the Buddha's teaching in your own country and abroad? In our country, at present, situation is somewhat doubtful, but with regard to Buddhism, it will revive for a long time. Nobody can remove Buddhism from our country. But I know there are Catholic actionists. They go to poor areas, people where when the country is under much trouble, then in some areas people become very poor. Then Catholic Church find a point and they send their people, Catholic actionists, to those areas and give money, food and such other things and try to convert people. They have done with regard to some very, very poor areas, but they do a very foolish thing. Though those people are so poor and they pretend to be Catholics, when the opportunity comes, they are again Buddhists. Such things they do, foolish things, they spend a lot of money for this. So they are not successful in our country. They can't remove Buddhism from other country because it has gone to the root of their heart. As their, in one way it is their national religion, in another way it is their culture. A culture was built through Buddhism. For about 2,000 years Buddhism was their own religion. As regards other countries now, the modern knowledge people get through the development of science has paved the way for Buddhism to enter those countries. On one side, there are free thinkers, rationalists, atheist movement, so many things, and their publications weaken the belief in all protecting God. And that belief is now being slowly, weakened. From my experience, I know when I travel so many countries, there are nominal Christians, all in name. When I ask about the Bible, they don't know. I know Bible. I have read Bible several times from the beginning to the end. But they don't know. They know nothing of that. But nominally they are Christians. So, situation is like that. Some time ago in 1973, I was invited to Manchester to give a talk by the senior lecturer of comparative religion of the university. His name is Mr. Young, and I was lodged in his house. In the evening, I think he has informed his disciples, his pupils, a vast number of students came to that house and gathered around me. They are undergraduates, some are in BA form, some are in MA form, so many, they sat down like you, and I was there. Then they began to just to converse, to talk about this and that. Then I asked a question. I asked some person, what's your religion? I'm a Buddhist. All these university students, many were Buddhist. I asked about their parents, and some said, we are admirers of Buddhism, still we have not become Buddhist. We are thinking about it. Then I asked those persons, what's the religion of your parents? Some said, very few said, Catholics. Many Methodists. Presbyterians. So different names we gave, names of the Christian sects they belong. Then I said, your parents belong to such some sect, some Christianity, Christian religion. Then why have you given it up during these young days? What is the reason to become Buddhist? Then one student said, sir, in our young days we are taught Bible in this school. Now we have grown up. We can't believe their theories, their teachings. I told them, tell me one thing you can't believe. We are taught that there is an Almighty, all-compassionate, all-knowing, omniscient God in the world. We can't believe it. I asked why. Well, Venerable Sir, last time, Hiroshima in Japan was bombed. Not less than million innocent children, million people died. If they are punished, if they are in a fighting position, fighting each other, then there is no harm. We don't blame of their being killed. These innocent little children, sick people, who have no connection with that war. But they were killed, this Almighty God was silent. Why is he silent? These are his people. created by God, his own children. But when they are killed by bombs, he is silent. If he knows everything, he must be seeing these things. If he is almighty, he must use his that all might to preserve, to save those people, leaving the fighters to fight and get punished. But these innocent children all were killed. So from this we have a great doubt about the existence of such a God. Then I asked them, did you ask this question in your church, a church father, church priest? Well, at school we ask these questions. They threaten us. They say, don't doubt, lest we will have to suffer in eternal hell. So they frighten us, showing some hell. They don't answer. When we urge over and over again to answer, then they say, it is a mystery, you can't understand. So such is the situation. Therefore we don't want such a religion. Several persons, the well-educated youth, said similar answer to my questions. And in 1982, when I was in London, Bihar, I was reading a book. A person, a gentleman of about 50 years, came over to me with a Sinhalese doctor, one living in England. The other person was an Englishman of about 50 years, well-built, majestic person. He came. Then I asked him to sit down and I said, I'd like to know who is this gentleman. Then he introduced himself. He said, well, I am the chief priest of, he mentioned a certain church, priest of that church. But I am a Buddhist. He said, I said, I can't understand. What is this? This is a mystery. You say you are a priest of a church, chief priest, and at the same time you say you are a Buddhist. How can this be? Well, sir, he said, with much faith and devotion I entered the church as a brother, and I got trained, and I became a priest, and now the head priest of, he mentioned the church, such church. But when I went on thinking about the teaching in this Christian literature about God and Saul and these things, I had much doubt. At last, I was convinced that this Christian teaching, this God theory, the Saul theory is entirely unscientific. Therefore, I gave up entirely. I gave up my belief in God and Saul as taught in Christianity. But as a profession, still I have to work there only Sundays. Sundays I appear before people, some foolish people come and make something called prayer and I listen, but I don't encourage them. I get away and come to my house and I carry out my way. Now I am a Buddhist. After I began to read Buddhist works, I was thoroughly convinced, and I became a Buddhist. And now I have come here to understand for two purposes. One, to buy a Buddha statue, if I can buy, if it is available here. And the other point is to clear a doubt about karma and rebirth. I believe karma and rebirth, but I don't understand how, without a soul or ego, to enter from this body to another body. If there is no such thing, how this rebirth takes place? This is my doubt. So, to clear this doubt, I came to you. The other point is, I want to buy a Buddha statue, because very beautiful Buddha statues are made by one English gentleman, one artist, and they put them in the temple, in one part of the temple bookshop, for sale. He said, I want to keep a Buddha statue because I am a Buddhist. Morning and evening I must pay my respect to this great teacher. I must bow down. It is a reminder to me that I am a Buddhist. If a Buddha statue is there, and I, morning and evening I pay my respect to him, at least placing a flower before the statue. For this purpose, to buy a statue I came. The other one, karma and rebirth. And I said, well, I try to clear your doubt about karma and rebirth. You believe rebirth? Yes, I believe. I believe. But what is going there to be reborn? I don't believe the existence of the soul, any unchanging thing that is passing from here to there. It is unscientific, I don't believe. Then I said, from Christian way I will answer your question. If I answer your question in Buddhist way, you don't understand, you have not thoroughly studied Buddhist philosophy. You know Christian way. In Christian way I will explain it, I told him. And I said, he was somewhere there, I was here. I told him, see my cloth, my robe. Yes. What is that? There is a robe. It's one thing called robe. If you come closer and examine, what do you see? And I told him, it is nothing but threads arranged according to certain order. Apart from threads, there is nothing. But there is something here when threads are arranged according to order. So there is a cloth. But when you go, when you examine closely, no cloth but threads. But threads have given a form. That form is called cloth. Now this much you have to understand first, I told him. Yes, I understood. Then, according to your Christianity, which you followed formally, there is self or soul, which is passing from this to any life, other, in heaven or hell or wherever. So there is such a thing according to that. Now the difference between our theory about this soul and what we call thought stream, difference is this. What you call soul at that time, what you see as soul, is not changing according to your belief. But according to our way of examining, it is momentary changing. The same thing has been seen, looked at from two angles. Buddha looked at it, at this process of happening, mental states, very clearly and closely, and saw momentary change. But your Christian teachers, from afar they look at it, they saw as cloth, as one thing, unchanging one thing. This is the difference. The same thing has been seen in two ways. One, in gross way, we saw as unchanging thing, but Buddha saw it is a series of or a stream of momentary changes. So it flows on. Then the priest, now it is enough. Now I have understood. I cleared my doubt. I am satisfied. So this is the situation in England. These Christian priests in most churches don't believe in Christianity. Secretly, they are Buddhist followers of Buddhism. And in 82, I was invited to give a talk on Buddhism in Christopher Church in Oxfordshire, about 70 or 80 miles from London. There was a convention, a big, great meeting, assembly of Christian priests of the whole area, of about 30 churches. All chief priests are assembled there on that night. So the chief that the priest, the chief priest in charge of Christopher Church, sent a phone message whether there is a monk you can send me to give a talk introducing Buddhism, because our priests who gather today, they know nothing of Buddhism. So please send somebody. Then this message came to the secretary of the Buddhist Society of London, Vihara. He is a Buddhist English gentleman. I've forgotten his name. Russell Webb. Mr. Russell Webb. Russell Webb came to me. Venerable sir, there is a very good chance. I asked, what is it? Today there is an assembly of Christian priests. They are in the church. Many priests will gather. They want you to give a talk introducing Buddhism. Then I said, I can go there. How can I go? About 80 miles away. Well, they will arrange. Still came, I went there, and I was very kindly welcomed. There was a vast gathering of priests, not less than 30, two or three laymen only. It is a meeting of priests. Then the chief monk, he was somewhat old, introduced me, and he asked me to give a talk. And I spoke to them, explaining Buddhism. After my talk was over, I said, those days my ears are very well hearing, no trouble. I asked them, now you can ask any question. The first question a priest asked is, according to Buddhism, what do you say about God? What is God? What do you think of God according to Buddhism? Then I told them, well, I can do it. You mentioned the word God. What do you mean by God? Please explain it to me. Then I'll give you my view. What do you mean by God? Please explain to me. but God is. But I know no Christian priest who have little brain is going to explain God, because he falls into much trouble. I know that. So they were silent. They kept silent. They didn't give any answer. Because this good idea changed from centuries to centuries. The God they taught some 50 centuries ago was not the same God that they teach today. So every century their God idea changes. So they can't explain. So they kept silent. Then I said, Buddhism is just like medical science. A doctor goes to see the patient. First, he examines, tries to diagnose the disease. And if he understands he is suffering from some disease, then he must make the patient understand you are suffering from this disease. Then the doctor has to find out the cause of the continuity of disease. Why this disease is not cured? What is the reason, what is the cause of it? And he finds out the cause, second thing. When he understands the cause of the disease, then he tries to understand whether it is curable. When he finds that it is curable, then what is the remedy, the treatment? Then he finds treatment. Then he, according to these four things, the disease, cause of the disease, curableness, that it is curable, and there is treatment for it. The doctor should know only these four things, and he should convince the patient that your disease, you have a disease, it is curable. This is the treatment. Apart from this, is there any other thing necessary for the patient to attain health, to get, to remove his disease? I ask them. Nothing. Suppose the doctor is going to teach him about the origin of the world or some geological question and so on. Will that knowledge cure his disease? No. A patient should understand that he is a patient, he is suffering. And there must be a cause, because there are other people who are not suffering. So there must be a cause. If the cause is rooted out, then there is health. For this purpose, there must be a way, a treatment. Only this much. One should understand to cure oneself if one is suffering from a disease. Similarly, the world is full of patients as the Lord Buddha saw them. Mentally, they are suffering from mental disease of ignorance and attachment to condition-changing things. Due to that, there are so many troubles in their heart, in their mind, in their ways of living, and so many spoiling in their heart, so many crimes in the world. All are due to their non-understanding the nature of life, nature of world. So Buddha saw the mental condition of people. He is just like a doctor. He saw the disease, the common disease from which the whole world suffers. Then cause of the continuity of disease. he saw. Then he saw it is curable. That there is health on the opposite side. He saw that. Then he found the treatment, the medicine for this. Only this much is necessary for a teacher who has come to save people from their suffering should teach. Apart from these four facts, whatever other teaching is not important. I told them. Then they didn't speak against it. Then one old priest said, well, it is very important. Very important point you told us. And another priest said, well, we accept Buddhism is very, very good. A very important religion. But it is very difficult to follow. For us in Europe, in these countries, very difficult to practice. I said, no, it is very easy for you, you wise people. No, very difficult things, no. You don't know what Buddhism is. So he asked me to explain it. Well, I asked, can you abstain from bad deeds? Can you stop doing bad deeds? Yes, I can do it. Can you abstain from bad speech? To speak good, to have good speech, and to avoid bad speech, can you do it? Yes, I can do. Can you think good thoughts? Yes, this is Buddhism. Do good deeds, speak good words, think good thoughts. Stop doing bad deeds, stop speaking bad words, stop doing or thinking bad thoughts. This is Buddhism. Why can't you practice it? Then they were very happy. Then they were just talking, discussing for a few minutes, and meanwhile a young priest came closely to me and said very secretly, please, can you kindly admit me to your Buddhist order? Then I said, if you want to. And because tomorrow, I told him, tomorrow I am leaving for America to Half Moon Meditation Center. Therefore, I can't do anything about that. I can guide you. You better go to Chitthas Buddhist Center. That is the big Buddhist center in Chitthas in England, run by Venerable American Bhikkhu Ramal Sumedho, Ajahn Sumedho. I gave him address, go there. Later I came to know that he went there. This is the situation in England and most European countries. Therefore, everywhere in the world, in the civilized countries, in the developed, the progress, the countries in progress, where people, learned people, majority of people are learned, there is a field for Buddhism. There is the answer to this question. Now time is gone. Many more questions are there, but I have no time. Now let us close. Yes?
Yes.
Please, what is the next program?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.